So far this year, according to the Washington Post, more than 800 people have been shot and killed by members of law enforcement. In the smartphone body cam age, each graphic new video of a so-called officer-involved shooting gives the public a chance to reckon with the stakes, the relative threat, the context, the general impunity, and too often, the racial double standards in the application of lethal force. That reckoning is a relatively new phenomenon, even though we have been awash in police shooting imagery for a century. In films and on TV, cops routinely gun down the bad guys without controversy. So observes the Post's Alyssa Rosenberg. The third installment of her series on the police in entertainment media is headlined in pop culture, "There Are No Bad Police Shootings." Alyssa, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Actually, Alyssa, in Hollywood, there are hardly any bad police in the first instance. There's heroes, there's anti-heroes, there's the whole mess of tortured souls beaten down by the job. But for the most part, they're all just trying to keep us safe. Why is that?
Joseph Wambaugh, who's a former LAPD detective sergeant who turned to writing novels and eventually helped create the show Police Story, says that the public wants to be comforted by the idea of the stoic cop who always makes the right decision, and if they pull their weapon and fire it, does so in a state of extreme calm and clarity about what they're doing. The stories that Hollywood tells create a presumption that any police shooting is good, because if we had stories that suggested that cops were emotional or unprepared or were making split-second decisions that sometimes were bad, we might feel more anxious about their role in our society. So moral and legal introspection is a big theme of an early generation of police stories.
How old was he?
22. First time I ever killed a man.
Mm-hmm.
What a good thing, Ann. I kind of wonder if maybe there wasn't some other way.
If you look back at Dragnet, Naked City, even Starsky and Hutch, there are stories in all of those shows where cops shoot someone and then spend the rest of the episode trying to figure out who this person actually was and hoping to reassure themselves that they did the right thing.
You mentioned Dragnet. Now, this was a very popular radio show in the 40s and became a very popular television show well into the 60s.
The story you are about to see is true. The names have been
Jack
changed.
Webb was the star and the producer. And yes, we had the cop who second-guessed himself after a shooting, but in every other respect, that show was essentially a propaganda piece, a PR piece for the LAPD, no?
Absolutely. Dragnet's a really interesting show because it's effectively a collaboration between the LAPD and Jack Webb. One of the things that happens early in Hollywood's history is that the Supreme Court rules that movies don't have First Amendment protection on the grounds that they're not original thoughts. They're just depictions of things that have already happened or recapitulations of someone else's argument. And so to fend off censorship and regulation by police departments and city and state governments, Hollywood makes a lot of accommodations, most famously in the form of the Hays Code, which, among other things, requires that movies don't show the extended success of the criminal against the forces of law. And when I interviewed Joseph Wambaugh, who knew some of the people who worked on Dragnet either as writers or as people who were approving the episodes, he said that one of the rules was that all shootings on the show ultimately had to be proven clean shootings.
But Joe, you're in a special kind of job.
I've been telling myself that, but it doesn't seem to help much.
Did he have a gun?
Yeah.
Did he use it?
Yeah.
Well, doesn't that make a difference?
And so the industry made a compromise that even after movies got their free speech rights back in the 1950s, was baked into pop culture's DNA by that point.
And is that because Hollywood was craven? Or because it turned out that the public just really liked having morally pure heroes and we could identify with and look up to and root for?
By the time that those restrictions are loosened, Hollywood has developed these tropes, audiences have embraced them, and there are social pressures on people not to diverge from that. As violent crime starts to take off in the mid-60s and 70s, you see much harsher attitudes towards police shootings. When Harry Callahan, the cop from Dirty Harry, shoots the Scorpio killer dead in defiance of the law.
You've got to ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
There's a lot of sympathy with him. He was an appealing revenge fantasy for people for a lot of reasons. He's not merely an executioner. He's someone who has come to believe that the law doesn't deliver justice anymore.
Callahan,
I don't want any more trouble like you had last year in the Fillmore District. Understand? That's my policy.
Yeah, well, when an adult male is chasing a female with intent to commit rape, I shoot the bastard. That's my policy.
In the 80s, as the war on drugs really kicks off in a big way, you see much more action-oriented scenes of police killings. It provides this image of police effectiveness, and it's great propaganda for the war on drugs. As crime declined in the 90s and into the aughts, you're able to see a lot more complexity, both moral and emotional, around police shootings. And so shows like The Shield and The Wire can afford to be a lot more critical. Hollywood likes its tropes. It is a politically liberal industry, but in terms of business decisions, it's a conservative industry. It moves slowly. It does not deviate from random tropes very often. And so, yes, someone like David Simon now has the freedom to make a show like The Wire, or Sean Ryan has the freedom to make a show like The Shield, but people still tune in huge numbers to whatever the existing hero cop franchise is, whether it's Law and Order or the CSI shows or the NCIS shows. And so I don't know that Hollywood is craven so much that it's oriented towards its bottom line.
Is there any evidence that the value system that Hollywood has at least perpetuated has transferred to our perception of actual events with real-life human beings and real dead ones?
Well, I think certainly one thing you see in a lot of the conversations about police-involved shootings is the sort of presumption of guilt on the part of the person who's dead. And that is something that is established over and over and over again in Hollywood. In those early stories I mentioned, even where cops sort of tortured themselves, they would always find out that the person they'd killed has been a bad person. In Naked City, when Jimmy Halloran kills someone for the first time, the person he's killed, the man's wife actually says to him, you know, he was no good, he was never sorry for anything. She basically implies that she's better off for her husband having been killed by the police. In Starsky and Hutch, the mother of a 16-year-old boy that Starsky shoots and kills tells Starsky, a mother knows what her son is, at least this mother knows. I mean, she essentially says that her son was incurably criminal, and it's very sad that he's dead, but she can't blame the police officer in question. So when you have these very powerful tropes of the people who ought to be grieving most telling police officers that, no, it's fine, that their relative is dead, that becomes part of a broader narrative that everyone who's shot by the police had it coming, either in that specific circumstance or more globally. And that's an attitude, I think, that is really prevalent in a lot of our conversations about real-world police shootings.
And one thing we should be clear about, even though we seem to be inundated with actual police shootings, it is a drop in the bucket compared to what happens on television every single week. I mean, do you have any scale for measuring the disparity?
The NYPD started tracking the number of discharges of officers' weapons each year. The number in 2014, which is the last year for which numbers are available, was fewer than 100. And that includes suicides, it includes accidents, it includes incidents where officers shoot animals. And so the number of times that a 35,000-person police force shoots their weapons at human beings is fewer than the number of cop shows that air episodes every week. There's an astonishing disparity between the number of police shootings or even uses of force that we see in pop culture and the number that actually happen in a city like New York.
It occurs to me that there's some language that I know only because I've seen it in cop shows and movies. Even the term shooter itself struck me as quite jargony when I first encountered it. And cold piece for the gun that the cop plants at the scene of a dubious shooting to make it look legit. Is there other language of Hollywood that we're now seeing in discussion of police-involved shootings or vice versa?
I think that a hallmark of authenticity for police shows has been a willingness to try and use the specific technical or slang language that cops actually use on the job. One term that was really jarring to me, but that has a very evocative ring, is the slang term no human involved, which is police slang that's been used in the past both to refer to crimes where, in fact, no human has been harmed, but also to refer to crimes that involve people who are considered subhuman in some way, whether they're sex workers or people of color. I was interviewing David Simon for this series, and I asked him how he developed the voice that he used in writing Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets, his book that was eventually adapted for television as Homicide: Life on the Street. And he said it wasn't something that he came up with. It was really a sort of evocative language and way of speaking that he picked up from spending time around homicide detectives. But he said it was interesting. There were these moments of distance, even in the LaTanya Wallace case, which he covered in that book, which was a case involving the rape and murder of a very young girl. Simon said he was listening to the detectives talk about the case one night, and one of them referred to her as this broad. And she's 11 or 12 years old. She's not a broad. But there was that sort of distance in the language that was, I think, emotional protection for the cops involved, but also made for very evocative language when you're writing about policing.
One thing you can't help but notice as these videos of police-involved shootings pile up is that they really look nothing like we've been accustomed to for the past century from Hollywood. Everything happens more suddenly. They're obviously less choreographed. There seems to be more general nervousness.
We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand out.
And suffice to say, the dialogue isn't much to speak of.
Did you shoot him? Did you shoot him? He better not be dead.
It just looks nothing like Dirty Harry or Naked City or NYPD Blue or Law and Order or any of the other Hollywood fare in which gunplay is constantly involved.
This is where I think there's a really interesting question for how Hollywood responds to police-involved shootings, because this is a genre that has a real fetish for authenticity. The idea is that they're communicating the truth of police experience. And so what happens when there is available, widely broadcast proof that what happens in a police-involved shooting looks nothing like what we see on screen? How does the entertainment industry adapt to that? And I don't know that that question has been answered yet. If one of the most dramatic, socially consequential moments of the job looks nothing like what we see on screen, how can Hollywood continue to depict police-involved shootings this way?
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been an On the Media Podcast Extra. I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.